Hello and welcome to the spring podcast of the Oldie magazine with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to have the great Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenne, who have written a terrific cover piece about Ronnie Barker, who would have been 90 this year, and Porridge. And there's also great news that two lost episodes of The Likely Lads have been rediscovered. And they're being released on the DVD along with the feature film The Likely Lads from 1976. So I think I'm right in saying there were 20 episodes of The Likely Lads, and amazingly, 10 of them were lost. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's right.
I think 12 were lost, and now it's 10. It's something like that. Yeah.
And this was just the idiotic BBC throwing them away. What happened?
Well, it was terrible. It's in the interest of shelf life. They never foresaw future of reruns, rerun channels, box sets, DVDs, Amazon, Christmas gifts. And so in the interest of space, they wiped programs. Dick worked after The Likely Lads. Dick worked on directed Not Only But Also. Half their episodes have gone, probably more.
Yes.
Definitely half of ours have gone forever. I don't know how they found these two.
Well, we live in hope that somebody will find in a garage. These were found in a garage. I don't even know where. I'd be very grateful to find the bloke who found them and buy him a drink. But maybe there'll be episodes found in other garages.
But two episodes of, what is it, Morecambe and Wise?
Were found in Sierra Leone.
So these are original bits of film that were printed at the time, is that right?
Well, I think in this case, this was not film. This must have been the whole episode, which was,
VHS. Would
have been on tape.
But
there's quite a lot of location filming, though, in particularly one of them. So when I saw them recently, it was very hard to remember them. I didn't remember them very well until it got to the location filming, and then I said, oh, I remember where that was. You tend to do that.
Because this is literally the first time you've both seen it in 50 years.
Yeah. Something like that.
They found one 4 years ago, which we wish they hadn't.
Right.
It was the worst episode we ever wrote.
And you talk about in your piece for the Oldie something Larry David says about all great sitcoms. He says they're set in circumstances from which people are unable to break away. And you say of The Likely Lads, they're trapped by class and environment. Whereas Bob desperately tried to improve himself, Terry happy, remaining working class. Was that how you envisaged it to begin with?
When we first wrote it, it was a 10-minute sketch for an amateur review of two blokes having a post-mortem, having had a date, intercut with the female view of the same evening, and that's all it was. I mean, we had no sociological insights whatsoever. It's interesting. I mean, obviously, it's nice that people are re-examining them and putting this in there, but it wasn't intended. I mean, it evolved. It was certainly inspired by the black and white movies at the time. I mean, we wanted to put the North on the screen, on the little screen, after it had emerged on the big screens, and so that was our motivation. But it's only later that people started to analyse the attitudes of what we were intending. What we were intending was to make a living, I suppose, at the time. You know.
But already their characters are emerging in these lovely lost episodes. So Rodney Bewes is wanting to go away somewhere, starting an upmarket.
Yes,
and,
he's more aspirational.
Yeah.
So there is that feeling, to go back to the original question about being trapped.
Yeah.
In a sense, though, when we had the chance to write something which would become a television series, which we never imagined, we were capturing the cultural shifts of the time. Where suddenly there was this social transformation in England where the old order was being brought down, and we saw it reflected. We weren't aware of that in those terms, but we were aware of this whole new wave of cinema and this whole new emergence of pop music, where everyone, musically, artistically, cinematically, in television, were working class. That had never happened before. Heroes were never working class. They were officers. Working class stoked the boilers. And so we loved those films, and so when we had the chance, we were saying, we'll try and write that on the small screen. We'll write something which is a comedy, but it hasn't been a comedy the people have seen, because they were in drawing rooms in suburbia. This is the north of England, because we just like all the heroes on television. It is the small scale version of that. Of course, that's easy to say now. Probably at the time we were just trying to make it funny.
Because we were just talking about the late great Albert Finney. So would you say the big screen was there first? Tom Courtney, Albert Finney,
Alan Bates, Richard Harris.
It's true to say that
that's exactly what we were watching. We weren't we exclude Galtinson because they're so great.
The first performance of Terry Colley was made by me in the Amateur Review, where I was shamelessly doing an impersonation of Albert Finney on Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. I'm not going to do it now. That's what it was.
And actually, we've just had this article by Tom Courtney about Albert Finney, and they both said they didn't realise they were part of some great Northern Renaissance. The same apply to The Likely Lads. You didn't think we are now writing a Northern comedy.
No, you don't. I mean, it's only in hindsight that people find patterns and parallels and things like that, which is understandable.
No, but it's interesting because all those actors who emerged in the 60s, who we were trying to emulate in a little screen, they had all had their accents ironed out of them at drama school. They took elocution lessons. And we heard a story when we were doing our documentary last year, that came out last year, My Generation. I remember talking to an actor. I think it was Malcolm McDowell, but I may be wrong.
No, I think it was Malcolm.
I think it was Malcolm, who said he remembers this feeling of complete liberation when he went up for a part with Lindsay Anderson, and he read, and Lindsay said, "Very good. Now read it in the voice you had in the schoolyard." And he said it was a moment of complete liberation, and that's what many of them felt. You know, and they've all been taught to speak English. If you're ever going to be a leading man, you'd better speak posh. And suddenly this was all dismantled, all went away.
And it really, nothing is precise, is it? But it's very quick. Is it? It's sort of what, 1960, it's post Elvis in 56.
It starts pre Beatles. It's 63 through 66, 67, that era. And we think, after what we'd written got made into a kind of pilot, that when it was originally an exam piece that Dick took as part of his director's course, we think the people who looked at it probably thought, oh my God, this is capturing the culture of the time. You see, these are the people. And I think they said, and it's a new channel, BBC Two, we should be adventurous, we should do things.
And it's cheap.
Let's do it. And it's cheap. Let's do it. And we were the beneficiaries of that.
And very quickly it becomes a huge hit as a result, because you've hit something new, is that right?
First must series have struck a chord. But it wasn't an enormous viewership, because it was BBC Two, which was a fledgling network.
26 people, I think. Maybe 28.
But then by the time the third series was on, yes, it'd become, but it was basically what you, they didn't use it then, it was a cult hit.
Right, and like all great series, there aren't that many of them, so there are only 20. Did you decide both to pull the plug quite soon, did you, on the original series?
Yeah, well, it was three series. We thought we'd done enough, and then we came up with a very good episode to wrap them out of our lives, where Bob decides to join the army, get away and broaden his horizons. Terry is left behind, feeling sort of left out, and decides, all right, I'll join the army too. And when he gets to the first base, there is Bob, who's about to be demobbed because he's got flat feet. So it's like the one who didn't want to be in the army is in the army, and the other one who did want to be in the army isn't, which amused all of us very much, including Jimmy Bolam, and that was the end of it. And then we left it for 6 years or so, and then came back to it when we both found we'd been thinking about them and what's happened to them over 6 years. Because what was interesting is there were 19 or something in the original series, and what happens between 19 and say 25 is fairly enormous in terms of the fact that most people, in terms of the class they came from, get married, settle down, and things get changed. So we thought it was an enormous mine to be mined. That's very bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And also the background of Britain changes massively, doesn't it? If you look at the film, The Likely Lads from 1976, there is industrial Britain being knocked down. So their repartee stays much the same, doesn't it? But the story changes. But it's, Britain has changed enormously in those 15 or so years, hasn't it?
There was always a vein of nostalgia with the guys. One of the first things that we discussed was that nostalgia kicks in very early. You don't have to be old to be nostalgic. You can be 18 and be nostalgic about how nice it was and how simple it was when you were 13. I mean, we've touched upon this talking to Jonathan Coe recently about his new book. And about the fact that the Olympics is now looked upon with enormous nostalgia by everybody, because it was such a unifying moment where everybody was proud to be British and proud to be doing it well and everything else. And it's not that long ago, and now it seems untouchable or unreachable. So it's the same theme.
And we're now more than 40 years on from the Likely Lads film. Do you think, If Rodney Bewes was still alive, you could still do a series or a film now? Or has Britain changed so much that it wouldn't really work?
Well, if it was a series about two old men, it wouldn't reflect Britain now.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't be part of it. They'd be marginalised, like writers of our age usually are in the business. They'd be marginalised people. The only things of interest, that the information they'd ever receive would come from their grandchildren.
Right.
So we'd be writing about two old men.
Okay, let's put it another way. You think Britain, you now both live in America, you think Britain has changed unrecognisably since then?
It has changed unrecognisably. It's fascinating, the diversity is wonderful, but we wouldn't be able to capture that.
Right.
It's not just an age thing, it's just access. You know, if we were living here all the time and being writers of some imagination, yes, we would capture it. Not when you're most of the time not here. It's astonishing. It's the language. The language has changed, and that's what we make our living out of. It's changed. There's a patois now. There's a different accents, different school, different diversity, different cultures. I was staying in a hotel 2 years ago in the West End, and there was a fight broke out in the street, even though it was the Haymarket. There was a really ugly fight kicked off. And I opened the window, and there was two groups of people. There were some girls, but there were mostly people, and they were screaming at each other. And I only recognized two words.
Seriously?
Fucking cunt.
Right, those don't change. Yeah.
Those were the only words I recognized. Everything else was a patois that I was unrecognized.
Oh, that's sort of what's known as Jafakan.
Exactly.
How extraordinary. Some things, though, don't change. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about social inequality in Britain now, and there's a lot of that in The Likely Lads, that in the film, the upwardly mobile one hasn't really made it, has he? So you still get the feeling that they're trapped. And that still applies to a lot of people today, doesn't it?
Well, there's a great resistance as writers to let any of their characters make it. It was when we were offered a sequel to The Commitments by Harvey Weinstein, and said, well, the beauty of the first film was that it looked authentic because they kind of, given all their personalities and natures and ambitions and aspirations, kind of didn't go anywhere. If you wanted to do a sequel and it was an American company, it would be Merrimack, they would want the grand ending. Now they made it in America. Now they're going to play the Hollywood Bowl. Now it's international superstar. That's not what we want to write about. Didn't believe it.
We worked out a great way to start the film. With Joey the Lips pretending to have cancer so that they all get back together for nostalgic reasons.
You've got a reason, right.
And all of that was great. And then you said, but how do you end it? Because you can't end in failure again. I mean, but in a way, the failure of the first film, of the band in the first film, was poetic. So we turned it down two or three times.
Our feeders end. They couldn't suddenly become rich, or we wouldn't have a nice second series.
Yeah, but it worked.
Lovejoy could never get the big score, otherwise that would be the end of that.
but you can move them, can't you? So Vitasen still works brilliantly in Spain.
You can move them sideways.
Yeah.
And when we brought it back, I mean, we did it
in Arizona and Cuba.
It did work. I mean, we did make Barry rich.
Yes, we made Barry
briefly,
right.
But then we found out that
it was all built on sand, cocaine,
and that his wife was sleeping with the bloke that he thought was her brother, you know, which that still appeals.
So it was about to be ripped away from him.
Yeah. So you can tinker with one or two elements, is that right?
Yes.
But you need the essential structure and.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
tension.
Otherwise, you lose that trap.
Yeah.
And that's really the point, isn't it? Failure's more interesting comedically than success.
Or struggling against the odds. Aspiration is.
Yes, which applies to John Cleese in Fawlty Towers, doesn't it? David Brent, yeah.
We had a funny. In Alan Hollywood, Partridge. They have all these, you know, stock expressions and arcs. And we did a film with Katzenberg. And he said, when we first met him, what's the film about? Three words. And you go, oh, fuck. And like, aspiration is a great answer, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Aspiration is a fantastic answer. Aspiration. But we nearly worked with this director who'd done the Mummy movies. And we were discussing this with him. He said, what happens when people say to you, what's the film about? Which all the films? And he said, "I always say the same answer: crime doesn't pay."
So the other one was Jonathan Lynn, who said to me, he said, "All stories are Cinderella." Now you can think about that and examine it.
It's a good answer, isn't it?
Said,
yeah.
They're all Cinderella, you know. So I think it's very important not to examine too much when you start.
It's still quite good though to come up with a very concise answer to that question.
Yeah.
Also, aspiration that's crushed as well. It's almost always crushed, isn't it? In those.
Yeah, but as long as you get that word out in the pitch.
Yeah. On the Lightning Lads, there were stories that Rodney Bewes and James Burnham didn't get on, and Rodney wanted to do a sequel. Is that right?
They had a tricky relationship, never on the set.
Yeah.
They had amazing mutual respect for each other. It was just that Jimmy was always plagued by the idea that if you get locked into a part, like John Thor and Dennis Waterman, like Basil Fawlty, like any, you know, with long-running series, it would jeopardize the rest of his ambitions.
Yeah.
It suddenly, he goes up to the National Theatre or Chichester and someone says, well, he's Terry, isn't he?
Right.
That haunted Jimmy, even though he did so much versatile work, you know, in theatre and film and television. It bugged him from the very start. Even after the... Was it whatever happened to you? The original series when he went into the newsagents and someone said to him, hello, so how's Bob? And he said, he's dead. Give me my Evening Standard, fucked off.
Right.
But so that didn't worry Rodney. Rodney could have been Bob forever.
Right. And you've written a piece, as I said, for the Oldie cover piece about Porridge. Ronnie Barker would have been 90 this year. Porridge, the series, began 45 years ago. You write very interestingly about how it began. You did a one-off program first. Is that right? Say how Porridge first got going.
Yeah. Well, The BBC commissioned a series called Seven of One. Seven shows featuring Ronnie Barker in different parts. They asked us to write two of them. So we did. And the first one was about a gambling mad Welsh family. And then Ronnie said, I'm interested in doing something in prison. And we'd just written a series called Thick as Thieves, where John Thor came out of prison and found his wife living with Bob Hoskins. So we thought, well, we can't do prison again. So instead we wrote Prisoner and Escort, where he was being taken to prison. Then they looked at both of them. They liked both of them. They both played well. And they said, which one of these would you like to do as a series? And we debated quite seriously which one it would be. And then, we chose Porridge. And then we're quite daunted about the idea of making prison funny. We went around three prisons and they're not funny at all.
Right.
Not in the least bit.
We went around three prisons and then said, why don't we do the Welsh one?
But it was too late by then.
Because what, inside those prisons, just really gloomy, people having a miserable
life. We went to Brixton, was the worst. We went down, and they have a kind of basement level, which is really for people who've been sectioned. And so these are straitjacket arrests. These are people who don't belong in prison. And also, all the prisons we went to are really, they're old Victorian buildings. They're like the porridge sets.
Right.
You know, they're cobbled floors and chains and loud noise. It was a long time before electronic buzzing. And it was deeply depressing.
You reminded me of the fact, when you said that we had a cocktail with the governor of Brixton Prison at the RAC trial. And he was a very nice guy.
Very nice guy.
Was he like the one in Porridge, the slide at the nervous?
No, not at all. Not at all. But this is before we've written it.
Yeah.
And we said to him, you know, what would you change if you could change anything? And he said, I would like prisons only to be inhabited by people who deserve to be in prison and not people who need a mental hospital or psychiatric help. That was very enlightened of him.
Or even drug addicts. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of people in prison who don't belong there, and particularly the, so it's also the fact that the sense you got when you went around prison was that most people had been defeated by life. And it was the thought, before we slit our wrists, we thought, okay, but it's going to be Ronnie Barker who walks in, you know. It was that reassuring thought that his character, we wanted to keep the reality of it, or at least not all the reality. You couldn't do all of it. You couldn't do the language. But we wanted to be in touch with that reality. It was important that Godber's character, as the young offender, you know, was admitting that he didn't like prison and he was depressed and he didn't know how to get through it. And then Fletcher sort of starts giving him pointers as to how to survive in prison. That seemed to be us to be very important, because that gave it a bedrock.
And you say that Ronnie Barker himself provided quite a few of the lines that you always accepted, is that right?
Yes, absolutely, because they were funny. And but he was always very respectful. I mean, he bought our approach to the show, which was not his original concept, but he liked it immediately. And he loved that character, actually, which was very gratifying.
And you say, to begin with, I think that's right, you were sort of inspired by Phil Silvers' Sergeant Bilko.
No, we weren't.
Too
he
jolly.
Was. No, he was.
He was. He was, all right.
Well, first of all, it's an American show which we've barely seen.
Yeah.
But it was very funny, but it was a lot of gags in it, and we weren't gag writers. And it was about a wheeler dealer. And we just said, it's just not our thing.
I think it's a wonderful series, but it was not
very funny.
Not what we write.
You do then go to say that. But Fletcher, by contrast, is a sort of old lag who's seen it all before.
Yeah. Just keep your nose clean, bide your time.
We always thought that if somebody had come in and said, "World War III's broken out," his response would have been, "Oh yeah." In other words, I'll believe it when I see it, but I'm not going to. You know, he would never give anybody anything. That was almost a mental sort of clue to his mindset.
And as an actor, you praise him as a brilliant actor, but say there's something extraordinary about him that he's funny even before he says something. Is that right?
That's true. No, I'm sure that before he'd done the Turanis and become, it was different. He was just an incredibly gifted actor. But once he became Ronnie Buck, that would have happened now, years later, with David Jason or Lena Rossiter, because they've now created this persona.
Yeah.
So they walk on a set in front of an audience and everyone's laughing already. Obviously, that makes it busy. But for Ronnie, not because he was a comedian, because he was just a wonderful comic actor. And I think we quote to you, didn't we, the Olivia story?
Yes, exactly what you say.
Which happened, and Ronnie was very touched, very moved, very knocked out.
Well, if you could say it for the people who haven't read the article, that Laurence Olivier...
Oh, yeah, it was some event, probably a BAFTAs or something, where Olivier came up to him and said, you're a brilliant actor. Not brilliant, not a funny man, not a brilliant comic. And Ronnie was very, very knocked out.
I think it's true.
And I think it's absolutely true. Ronnie was an exceptional actor.
I directed him in the Porridge movie, and I found him to be quite superb and wonderfully astute about, you know, where to put the camera. I mean, the technical side of it as well. Incredibly cooperative, but he was always very true to whatever he was doing. I think he could have done it better.
And he's very good on Porridge when he's not being funny, when he's being angry or very serious at Godfrey.
Completely worked, doesn't it?
He was a master. Sorry to interrupt. He was the master of the art of television comedy, because it's a hybrid. It's you're filming it, but there's an audience there. So most actors are quite disconcerted with that. They go on for, and then in rehearsals, everything, last rehearsal, everyone's exceptionally good, and then when you go on the floor, somebody is not going to get it right. Someone's going to walk on a lap, tread on it. They come in too quickly, and they think, sorry, it's because they think they're just going to say the line and like in an honest interplay, but then this audience laughs, and they realize they've killed.
Yeah.
But Ronnie was a master of that. That was his wheelhouse. He was such a master of timing. Wait the joke, wait for it then. And he loved that interaction with the audience. Where most actors find it quite frightening.
He never wanted to do the warm-up. It was interesting. He didn't want to come out and do a warm-up. He wanted them to meet him as Fletcher first. But if something went wrong, you know, something went seriously wrong, he immediately took stage, stepped out of character, talked to them, and basically used the moment, you know, to his advantage. He was brilliant, but he didn't want to push himself as Ronnie Barker before the show.
And you praise Richard Beckinsale, who would have died 40 years ago this year at the staggeringly young age of 31. He comes across wonderful looking, but a charming and gentle figure. Is that what he's like in real life?
Yes, delightful. And very laid back, too. I mean, he was, you know, he the least likely person to have a heart attack. It wasn't really a heart attack, it was a freak congenital heart problem. That nobody had detected and suddenly went. But I mean, he was very laid back to the point where I can remember Ronnie saying to him, "Come on, Richard." And, "Oh, all right." You know, it was really sort of, but they had a very close relationship, and Ronnie was enormously affected by his death.
And you tell a very moving tale about working with Kate Beckinsale.
Yes.
What did she say to you?
Well, we went to work on this film, Pearl Harbor. She was the lead, and her mother flew out. We were all in Hawaii, and we had lunch, and of course we'd known Richard's wife from years before, but not seen her for a long time. And Kate said she found it reassuring on our first big major part that we were there. And then she said, subsequently, she said, how old was Kate?
Four when her father...
She said, I got to know who my father was through watching reruns of Porridge, which was very moving.
And you praise everyone in the cast, but particularly Fulton Mackay and Brian Wilde. Again, did you cast these supporting actors?
Sid Lutterby, who'd mentored Dick with his first directing stint, and then several years later comes back and does Porridge. Sid's work.
And you'd written them as they're fantastic, but as these two opposing.
Oh, we had written them, but he just cast them perfectly.
And what was Paul Mackay like in the flesh? Anything like?
No, nothing like his character. He was the most delightful man, wonderfully well-rounded. You know, a real Renaissance man. He was an artist. He was interested in literature.
He was quite spiritual. He did. Meditate. He's a meditator. And he and my wife got on very well on a vacation, both into the same things and yoga. And he was quite a spiritual man.
And Brian Wilde again. It's so hard to think about.
Brian was as he kept his life as nondescript as his characters. he'd show up for rehearsal and he'd have a chuckle and have a laugh, cup of tea, then off he went home. But we never socialized with Brian. We never saw him out of hours.
No.
He didn't, you know, come to the bar after the shows. But after he died and we'd both written a kind of obituary, we heard from his wife thanking us. We didn't even know Brian had a wife, had children, had daughters, whatever.
I hope she wasn't like a wife in Porridge, but of course she was.
I'm sure she was.
more generally, I was wondering about how you work together. Barry Cryer, who does a lot of work for the Oldie, sends his regards. He says he thinks double acts as writers, there's always someone at the typewriter, someone doing the walking around, tearing their hair out. Is that how it works with you two?
Yeah.
Who's the writer?
I walk around, because he's at the computer, and just because it's a legacy. First thing we wrote was in a pub in Earls Court. It was a yellow legal pad. He had much the better handwriting, so he took the ballpoint, and it's just stayed like that ever since.
And the other thing Barry said, you said I should ask you, is he was struck that writing double acts tend to be very, very close, living out each other's pockets, whereas acting double acts, Laurel and Hardy, don't necessarily, not they don't get on, but they don't see so much of each other. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's because we see each other every day.
Yeah. But you could still take the side of each other, couldn't you?
But the acting relationships, whether it's Morton and Wise or Laurel and Hardy, they come together for a very intense period of work and then go away until the next worker, except Laurel and Hardy made so many films that probably were never out of each other's company.
But do you have disagreements, do you, or is it very...
We have disagreements, but there's no arguments. Yeah. Some journalists did ask us if we had to, and so we decided just to make it up. And we said that we'd go into his back garden and do kickboxing, which is with his wife as the timekeeper.
And you live very close to each other in LA?
We live at two streets.
Right.
I know, it's so incestuous.
Well, when Marks and Gran came to an Aldi lunch, they used each other's credit cards. I don't know if you do that.
They did?
No, we don't do that.
No, Noah and Mo, they get quite tetchy with each other.
Yes, they do.
They do.
They
contradict each other continually.
Yes, they do. That's quite
But neither one takes offence. It just goes straight over their heads. No.
No, they seem so close. And how does your working day work?
Tuesday, 9:30
to about 4.
4:35. If we were in pre-production, if we were making something, then it would be more intense. But that's all right, because actually one of all those mountains of scripts is actually in pre-production.
We tend to break off to watch footy at lunchtime.
Right. Difficult with the time difference.
The time difference usually works quite well for midweek games. For weekend games, that's another matter.
And your most recent thing we've seen over here is Chasing Bono, which was originally a book by my old Telegraph colleague, Neil McCormick.
Yep.
And it has been a play and a film, is that right?
We did it as a film.
Yes.
And then, just quite recently, thought that it would make a great play. So we had it on at the Soho Theatre, and I hope it's going to Dublin next.
Yes, we like it very much.
We had such fun with that, and it was a good play, and it was a terrific experience here. But then we've had another theatre project, and 2 weeks ago in Toronto, that's a rock musical.
Right.
And that was basically kind of the big tryout. Now we want people to...
Can you give a clue what's it about?
It's just a rock musical, a regular story, but it's using the music of an 80s band called Foreigner, who had a massive amount of hits.
Yeah.
So that's what people in the theatre audience do. When the next song comes up, they go, oh, fuck.
It's not about Bohemian Rhapsody.
It's an original story set in a steel mining town.
But it's not a commitment mark to...
No.
Not about a band. Although it's good about... There is a musical element in it. It's two brothers in
but
the
it's,
band.
But it's fictionalized. It's nothing to do with Foreign itself.
With Chasing Bono, was it strange taking real life, which you then had to change it a little, didn't you?
Yes.
To produce a plot.
Yes. Yeah, we fabricated something With Neil's permission.
Yeah.
But otherwise, the elements are exactly. We were very faithful to Neil's memoir, which we both loved when we first read it years ago.
Did you feel restricted by having to sort of by having non-fiction as part of the setup? You know, the whole your work has been entirely fiction.
No, not at all. Not at all. It was just such a great story. We wanted to fictionalize his non-fiction piece, but fine. It just really worked in the theatre. It's like it's a rock and roll fable. It's about that narrow line between fame, global fame, and total obscurity.
Yeah. And you referred earlier on about now living in America that it's harder to get the vernacular right over here. Does that then restrict the things you can write about? So it's fine to talk about rock bands because they're sort of international.
Music's all right. Rock and roll's all right. But although we don't understand the music business anymore, I mean, it's changed so drastically. I had a seminar on it the other week from my godson, Matthew Healy, whose band is incredibly successful.
Which is what
just won the Brits, best album, best British band. Just about the whole way everything has changed, you know, about the way you release product, the way you promoted the branding.
1954. I was close, but you hadn't mentioned that.
No, 1975, and it was just so there's always something every week that's changing, just as it is with technology and architecture, everything. And it's pretty exhausting trying to keep up with everything. So I think we probably felt much more comfortable writing a period piece now.
Right.
Well, the last series we did in England was indeed a period piece, Spies of Warsaw. So you have no problems with being trendy.
Do you feel restricted by all the Me Too stuff and the culture change? Because actually looking back at Lightly Lads, and particularly at Porridge, there's very little that seems dated or sexist. There's a bit where Ronnie Barker's daughter comes to the prison in a low-cut top, but that's very funny. But you feel you've got to censor yourself now in any way?
There's one or two references to the gay side of life in prison that I think we would ease up on now, except that I would say in our defence that Fletcher's character was always totally tolerant. You know, there was never a sense of intolerance about him. You know, it was just, again, gayness in prison was a fact, you know, and he accepted that. He didn't make any judgments.
And you do your porridge, anything to get on, the old lag aspect.
Yeah.
Don't cause trouble, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
You know Neil, don't you?
Well, I did know with the Telegraph, but not well, but yeah, no, a nice bloke.
Well, because of cultural diversity, there is pressure on us in every play to have a more representational cast in terms of colour, ethnicity, and it happened with Chasing Bono, and we said, well, you know, we can't, in all fairness, we can't have a black Bono, because, you know, that would not make sense.
Yeah.
And they said, the people who are the guardians of this say, well, an audience is colourblind. And you said, well, fine, we have a black Prospero, but Bono is a pretty famous U2. So in the end, and we're not against it, it was absolutely right. So we made one of our characters was Indian. And so we told Neil, had a dream, and he said, oh, by the way, and of course they're all real people, real life characters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We said, your wife is now Indian. Just tell her before she comes to opening night, because she might be a little surprised.
She's cool about it.
She is cool about it, completely.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good place to stop, and I'm really grateful to Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenny for their fantastic podcast and their wonderful cover piece in the spring issue of The Oldie.